Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. The instructors of Ben Spears Stamps Baxter School of Music in Nashville bring their expertise in Southern gospel music to the MTSU campus July 12th through the 24th. It's a unique singing school that will feature classes in theory, songwriting, sight singing, and ear training, as well as private lessons in voice, guitar, bass, and piano. And here to describe it further is Dr. Stephen Sheeran, professor of music at MTSU. Thanks for being with us today.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
What we're talking about here is called shape note singing. So to start out, could you define shape note music for us?
Well, in one sense, there really is no shape note music. There's shape notation. And in shape notation, whereas note heads are generally oval when you look at music scores.
Sheet music, yeah.
Yeah. In this kind of music, they use that oval shape, but they also use several other shapes as well to help you know where you are in a major or minor scale, for example, in the kind of music we're going to be talking about or the notation we're going to be talking about. Whereas, if you remember from Sound of Music, Do, Re, Mi, Fa, Sol, La, Ti, Do, each one of those syllables has a different shape. And so it helps you know, or helps you read the music, actually, to sing it when you're looking at it.
How is this, I don't suppose it would be accurate to say, preferable or not preferable to a regular piece of sheet music, but how is it different? How is processing it in your head different from processing it in your head if you were looking at a regular piece of sheet music with oval notes?
That's a very good question. And I can only answer that, since about 3 years ago, actually. I've been trained to read regular music notation, like most people who learn to read music notation. And I've done it most of my life, and I'm in my early 50s now, so it's been a while. I began to read from seven shape notation only about 3 years ago. And I found that after about a week of doing that, that it began to kick in as another support system. That is, when I'm sight reading a piece of music and I'm trying to figure out, okay, what's coming next? Because while you're singing one thing or playing one thing, you're actually looking ahead a little bit to see what's coming, so you'll be ready to do that when it arrives. And there are various techniques you use to figure out, okay, what's the next note and how long is it going to be? And after I'd done this about a week, I realized that there were moments when it just kicked in. It was second nature. I saw a particular shape. I knew it was a la, let's say, in the scale.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay, oh yeah, la is this pitch. And I did all this in my mind very quickly and silently so that it helped me find the next pitch.
How old is shape note singing and how did it develop?
Boy, that's
a little that's complicated.
That's a long history, Jenna. Uh-huh. Shape note notation was first developed right around 1800. In the Northeast. I think it was first published out of Philadelphia. Initially, they used four shapes, and some people in your audience may be familiar with sacred harp singing or music from Southern Harmony or sacred harp, and that uses four-shape notation. Actually, the reason they used four shapes was that because at the time, they were actually learning scales by singing four syllables. So let's say if they were going to train you to sing a major scale, and as an aside here, but a very important aside, this is important in training congregations to sing from notation. So it's important for churches that they have people in their congregations who can read notation. But when they were teaching major scale, they would say, all right, sing it like this. Fa, sol, la, fa, sol, la, mi, fa, which is not the system we use today. But the point is they're using fa, sol, la, and mi. So they assigned a different shape to each one of those syllables. In 1846, again in Philadelphia, a fellow by the name of Jesse B. Aiken came up with a system because that fits seven different syllables. They had imported, let's say, the continental European system, which was do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, si, do. And so he said, all right, since we have seven notes in this scale, and we're now using seven syllables as opposed to the old English system of four syllables, we should have seven shapes instead of four, one shape for each different syllable. And so, to put it simply, it really grew from that.
How did it come to be associated with Southern gospel since it originated in the Northeast? Another long story?
A very good question. The market for the tune books, and that's what they call them, the market for the tune books that used the shape notation was among those who were moving west, to the west into, let's say, into the western United States and beyond at that time, of course, and also south, especially down the great Virginia Valley into Tennessee, Shenandoah Valley being a part of that. And so, in addition, people in the northeastern cities, let's say the better educated type, shunned this notation because it's sort of like a bike with training wheels. You know, they would disparage it, for example, as dunce notes.
They felt they had progressed
beyond
this.
They didn't need it. They felt they didn't need it. Whereas people who were didn't know a lot about music found that this was an easier way to learn how to read notation, and they really took to it.
So it came in handy for people who were too poor to afford formal music training.
Very good point. These people were getting formal music training, but in groups, and also from people who were not that well trained themselves. So it really became associated with people on the frontier, people who lived in rural areas, even in New England. But again, not so much in Boston, not so much in New York, etc.
It's just like learning another language, actually.
It really is.
You're getting to the same message, but you're getting there through a different means of communication. What are the backgrounds of the teachers at the Stamps-Baxter School of Music? Will any MTSU faculty be collaborating with them in the school?
Probably not. Probably won't be any collaboration much between MTSU faculty and these faculty. These people tend to be people who have grown up in what we'll call the Southern Gospel tradition. They grew up in that tradition. They grew up going to singing schools in which they learned to sing shape notation. They learned all the kinds of things that are going to be taught in this school. A lot of these people have careers in part as performers either in Southern gospel or contemporary Christian music, some of them. They are publishers in some cases. They're songwriters in many cases. They're instrumentalists, especially pianists, and they're song leaders. So they've really been a part of this tradition, and I find, frankly, one of the reasons I'm working on it is because it's hidden to much of America. You say that to a lot of people who are in this tradition, and I would bet a lot of people in Middle Tennessee, they'll say, well, you know, I hear this at church every Sunday morning. But in fact, outside the group of people who sing this kind of music, the music associated with this notation, there's very little knowledge about it. If you look at the main histories of American music written by our most knowledgeable scholars of American music, this is basically missing.
Some people of the older generation here in Middle Tennessee might have gotten a smattering of it because many secular country music stars also had produced gospel albums in which they do nothing, release an album of nothing but traditional gospel songs on it, because it was part of their heritage.
Right.
But maybe with the advent of contemporary Christian music, the younger generation of country stars is not quite as interested in reviving those old standards.
That's a very good point. People know, for example, I'll Fly Away, but they know it primarily from performances by solo artists, usually. But in fact, that was written, Albert E. Brumley, the guy who wrote that, was a member of the Church of Christ, maybe I should say of a Church of Christ. And he was a part of this Shape Note and singing school tradition, the publishing tradition which went along with that. The best known names are the James D. Vaughan Company, the Stamps Baxter Company, for example. And he wrote that song in the early 30s, published it in a seven-shape songbook, gospel songbook, convention book, they call it. And, I mean, he wrote it in four parts. I mean, he was trained to know the basics of harmony and know the part writing rules, the same kinds of things students learn in our freshman theory classes here at MTSU. He learned that in singing schools and wrote songs. He didn't just write the melody and the words. He wrote all four parts and expected and surely heard all of his songs sung, probably without piano accompaniment, in part because he was Church of Christ, but just with four-part singing.
Can we expect to see any stars of the Southern gospel tradition make an appearance at the school?
I'm not sure I would say expect. Oh, well, yeah, in some cases you certainly will. And there's a very good chance that those not associated with the school will show up. For example, the fellow whose name sort of heads the school, it's called Ben Spears Stamps Baxter School. Mm-hmm. Ben Spear is, let me polish up my French here, is the eminence grise, the gray eminence of today of Southern gospel music. He came, grew up as a part of the Spear family, which was one of the most important groups in the history of Southern gospel. And so Ben will be there almost all the time. Plus, Ben is the music director for the Gaither Homecoming videos. And those videos among Southern gospel folk are very, very popular. And so a number of the people who teach at the school are those people who participate in those videos. And so, you know, anybody who knows those videos are going to be, you're going to be hanging out with, eating lunch with, eating dinner with, singing with people who are performing on those videos, people who are professional performers. In addition, they have, and I've not gone to that many evenings, but I've gone to a few, and they have really wonderful musicians come in sometimes and perform in the evening. And I've heard just some jaw-droppingly good music in those evening sessions. And, you know, they're, for the most part, open to the public, I'd say. I don't want to speak out of turn here, but I think most people can get in without paying any kind of admission fee, you know, because it's done for the school.
Right. And unless, of course, you are coming to the school as a student, which we'll get to in due course here.
I will say in recent years, you know, the Florida Boys have dropped in. That's a big name. Bill and Gloria Gaither have dropped in. People like that will drop in. So,
and when I was a kid, the television Sunday morning Nashville, especially Channel 5, was full of gospel music TV shows. It featured the Oak Ridge Boys, the Singing Spear family, the Florida Boys you mentioned, the Happy Goodman family. Mm-hmm. I'll never forget that woman and the Happy Goodman family. and other such groups. So if this kind of music is your passion, since I don't really see those kinds of shows on Sunday morning television anymore, how do you go about making a living at it these days and getting some exposure like that?
Well, in the case of professional gospel, which is actually a little removed from the singing school, we might talk about that, but there is a market out there. There are radio stations devoted to this. There is now a gospel channel or Southern Gospel channel, and you can watch the homecoming videos on that. They certainly sell recordings, and they tour. I mean, these people tour constantly. There are festivals in various places. For example, I think of the Albert E. Brumley Festival, since I was talking about Brumley, which takes place in southwestern, I believe it is, Missouri, either south central or southwestern Missouri. That's been going on for 30-some years. It'll be coming up in early August. And there'll be four or five nights of that. There's the National Quartet Convention in Louisville, which takes place over the course of 7 or 8 days in September. And there are various other places. But also, you'll find them performing in local churches. And the thing is, if you're not really into that network, you probably won't hear about it. I remember, what's the family? The Chuckwagon Gang, which came out of, I believe it was Fort Worth, Texas, or at least was on the radio out of Fort Worth. They sort of last minute were performing in Bellwood Baptist Church here in Murfreesboro, and there were not many people there. You know, it's that kind of thing. So you have to sort of be in the loop to know about this, but they are around.
Okay. Do they use the new media? Do they Facebook, Twitter?
I think they do all that.
YouTube, yeah. All of the above?
They certainly have their websites, let's put it like that. There are blogs dedicated to Southern gospel music. Facebook and that sort of thing, I'm not so sure about, although I can tell you that some of the people I associate with and people who will be teaching at this school certainly do have Facebook pages, because they're my Facebook friends. So,
there was something that you mentioned in an email to me in describing the piano style mm-hmm. used as a cross between slide, honky-tonk, and blues piano on the one hand and more popular styles on the other. I had always heard, and correct me if I'm wrong, that some religious singers don't care for the integration of anything in their music that smacks of honky-tonk or the blues because they think that's the devil's music.
Sure.
So how did those types or styles of piano playing integrate themselves into this type of religious music then?
Well, I just want to, unless I misheard you, I want to correct one thing. Not slide piano, but stride piano.
Oh, stride.
So
okay,
where your left hand is moving, very much like ragtime. Mm-hmm. Well, how things like that get incorporated, it's because people like to hear it. And when people like to hear something, there's probably going to be a performer or a group of performers who are willing to do it. And that's how it happens.
They just hear how its implementation in secular music really got people moving and stuff, and they figured, hey, you know, it sounds good and they like it. If we can use it to communicate about the Lord,
absolutely.
Why not? How can it be of
Jesus?
The devil?
Absolutely. If it brings people to Jesus, it's okay. And, of course, really we're talking about cultural difference here. We have a wide range of musical practice, even in a place like Rutherford County. But it really also gets to association. It's what people or enough people associate a certain kind of music with. If you associate, let's say, stride piano or honky tonk with behavior that you don't think is acceptable among church-going people, then you're going to be perhaps repelled by that music. Or perhaps you're willing to listen to it outside of church but not in a church service. Or perhaps you embrace it and use it in your church service. There, you can slice this into very, very thin slices of difference. And it really comes down to the culture in which people are raised, what they're used to, what they think about certain things.
Yeah, you know. Maybe the generations, too, have passed, because we're several generations removed from the era in which you'd go into a brothel and the piano player would be providing the musical entertainment on the first floor.
Well, let me just tell you right now, I would never go into a brothel.
I trust.
Now that I've got that out of the way.
I trust. I mean, you know, ragtime was, you know, some wonderful stuff, but maybe people saw that Scott Joplin died of venereal disease and they thought, okay, the devil did that
Makes
to him.
Makes sense, yeah, yeah. Or like when Thomas Dorsey, you know, began, I mean, this was, what was his name, Georgia Tom? The guy who, from Georgia, who up in Chicago really sort of got black gospel going in a big way, let's say. I mean, he brought in blues piano and associated it with Christian lyrics. And as you might expect, I mean, people had been hearing this guy perform Tight Like That. That was his big hit, you know. Mm-hmm. And we weren't talking about Jesus there.
No.
And so they really didn't want this music. And I'm talking about black churches did not want this, didn't think it was acceptable. Similarly, white churches, well, really throughout the last several hundred, 400, 500, 600 years of history, certainly since the Protestant Reformation, there has always been resistance to newer styles of music, because very often the newer styles are associated with, let's say, not subjects that were not sacred. Mm-hmm. And so there tends to be a lag, a certain type of conservatism among sacred cultural settings as opposed to secular cultural settings. These things are always brought in. For example, I think of J.S. Bach. One of the things when he was hired by the city of Leipzig, the sort of the job that he held longer than any other, he was hired actually to be the Leipzig cantor, which means he was in charge of music of the entire city. Well, the committee that hired him basically said, we don't want to hear any opera. You know, opera was not a very savory musical style at that point. In fact, very often, where there was opera, there were also prostitutes. And so people would actually go to the theater to pick up prostitutes. And so they're saying, no, we don't want that in our churches. This has continued and continues today, although today the music business, the music industry, is changing so rapidly that performers are very quick to use new styles of music in the service of Christian music.
I think of traditionally, when I think of this type of music, is four guys, a deep bass, a really high-pitched tenor, almost falsetto, mm-hmm. and a couple of guys right in the middle,
yes.
Either baritone or...
And second tenor.
Yeah, second tenor. But it's really more diverse than that rubric, isn't it?
It really is. In part, you're right. The stereotype is the male quartet. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we're really talking about a quintet because they usually have a pianist at least with them. But, of course, they're family groups, they're trios, they're solo artists. But even now, if you go to the National Quartet, after all, convention in Louisville, which is really the big, I think, Southern Gospel gathering, you'll hear plenty of male quartets with exactly the characteristics you describe.
And how does the female vocalist fit in here, or female instrumentalist for that matter?
Pretty easily, as I can tell, as I see it today. And they've been around for quite some time. You referred, I think her name is Vestal Goodman.
Mm-hmm.
You referred to Vestal Goodman, but there have been female performers since, throughout the heyday. I mean, the Chuck Wagon Gang had two women. That was basically a family group. The Spear family had... The women participated in that. The Lefevers had women participating in that. So women have been very much a part of this, but it's just that the male gospel quartet, and by gospel here I mean that white gospel heard primarily in rural areas in the South and Midwest, and of course elsewhere, but that originally was the thing, white male quartets, and they sort of got a kickoff, at least in their association with gospel, with James D. Vaughan, when in 1910 or 1911, I forget exactly which year it was, he hired young men to be his quartet, and he sent them around to perform, usually free of charge, in various places, the goal being to sell his convention songbooks. That's where the money came from, those convention books. And that market really dried up in the 50s. But the singing school, like the Stamps Baxter Singing School, that really was about training people who would eventually buy their books.
What kind of people do you think that this school will appeal to? People who are already steeped in the tradition, collegiate music majors, people who have heard it but don't know much about it, all of the above?
Mostly people who are steeped in the tradition. I've had a number of conversations with Ben Spear, again, the fellow who for whom the school is named. And Ben says that in this particular school, I mean, this school, I should say, is a little unique. Number one, it's really more professionally oriented than any other singing school that I've been around, and I've visited most of them. A lot of the people who come to this school want to have careers in Christian music. But also, as Ben says, most of the people who come to this particular school hear about it through the Gaither Homecoming videos. And so they don't come, let's say they did not grow up in a church necessarily that sings the old Southern Gospel standards. They did not, in many cases, grow up participating in the convention tradition where people buy a new book every year and they'll maybe drive several hundred miles to sing together on a weekend to sight read from new books and go to other singing schools. This is a little unique. So again, most of the people who will come to this will either be from the convention tradition, from churches that sing that use seven-shape notation and or sing Southern gospel music, and also people who are familiar with this world through the Gaither Homecoming videos.
But this sort of experience, even so, does still help to keep the tradition alive by passing it on from generation to generation.
Yes, I think it does. I think a lot of the people who are in the convention tradition wish that it would help quite a bit more than it does.
To spreading it to new audiences.
Well, they're concerned because their tradition, and this is one of the things I'm trying to document, they're concerned because their tradition has been on a downward slide since the 1950s. And they love what they do. They love the music. They love many things about it. They love the people that they're around. And they don't want to see it die. And it seems to me that actually the best thing that's happening in this world, in that world, is the singing schools. The singing schools are really the thing that are really making a comeback. More and more, especially young people, attend these schools. There are increasing number of schools. You'll get a new school started every few years. So, you know, there's something positive there.
The Ben Spears Stamps Baxter School of Music in Nashville will be teaching on the MTSU campus from July 12th through the 24th. If you want to find out more about it, if you're interested in attending, what should folks do?
Well, I would go to probably the website. And the address or the URL is simply stampsbaxterschool.com. If you just do a Google search of Stamps Baxter School, it'll come right up.
And it'll give you information on the fees, living arrangements, and all the particulars. Dr. Stephen Sheeran, thanks for being with us today.
It was my pleasure, Jenna. Thank you.
This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Please join us again at this same time next Sunday. You can catch the podcast at mtsunews.com at your leisure. And don't forget, we're also available on iTunes.